Hey, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Expanded Perspectives from the Archives, revisiting the conversations that helped shape this show. On today's show, we're going to go back and listen to an interview we did with a really cool guy named Mr. David Weatherly. Now, at the time of this interview, we were talking to him about his new book at the time called Strange Intruders. If you're not familiar with David's work, he's written all kinds of books on cryptids and folklore, things like Black Eyed Kids, The Van Meter Visitor, Eerie Companions, Haunted Churches, and others. And my favorite part that he's doing now is he's writing a book on each state in the nation. And right now he's done like 15. So if you're interested in getting a book that's all about the cryptids and stuff in the state that you live in, dude, go on over to Amazon and pick you one up. So far, he's written about Illinois, South Dakota, Wisconsin, Iowa, Indiana, Vermont, Maine, Alaska, Florida, of course, Florida, South Carolina, Georgia, Texas, Colorado, Arizona, Nevada, and Utah. They're really cool. We have them all, and one day in the Expanded Perspectives Library is going to have all 50 states. I can't wait. It's going to be cool because, man, anybody wants to bring up any state, you can just go over there and reference it. It's pretty cool. Well, without further ado, let's get into the interview. Enjoy. All right, guys, as promised, we have worked around like wild men and we have caught Mr. Weatherly on a timely manner whenever he is slowly settled down. So now we've got him, Mr. David Weatherly. David, how are you doing?
Hey, guys, thanks for having me on.
Man, you, sir, are insanely busy. Do you ever sleep? Are you part vampire, David?
I'll never tell.
All around the world he travels. In some of the most interesting places, and also the travels that you do some research over some of the creepiest, craziest things that people are studying, and you're kind of leading the charge.
Well, I hope so. I'm just pursuing what really fascinates me, and, you know, this stuff has, I've been interested in it since I was a kid, and, you know, I've never slowed down with delving into every aspect of, I use the broad term paranormal, but really that encompasses a lot more than people commonly think it does now. But yeah, you know, ancient mysteries, psychic phenomena, of course, haunted locations, UFO cases, cryptozoology, the whole gamut. I'm completely fascinated by it. So I spend all my time doing that. And that's, it drives me and I love doing it. So, you know, people ask me, don't I ever slow down or you know, take time out to rest? And really, I enjoy doing this so much that no, not really.
It definitely seems that way. Well, most everybody, especially I'm sure all of our listeners, know of you as the man that kind of brought forth all the information with the Black Eyed Kids. But what people don't realize is you've been involved in much more for much longer. That's just a small little segment of the pie chart of what you actually encompass.
It absolutely is. And, you know, I always like to, anybody who knows me knows that I will always give credit to other people. And I do like to point out that there were some other people who wrote about the Black Eyed Children before I did. Jason Offit, who had written about it quite a bit on his blog and mentions it, I believe, in a couple of his early books. Brad Steiger wrote about the Black Eyed Children. And really, when you start delving into the whole spectrum of these Black Eyed Child encounters, you'll find bits and pieces of it spread all over the place. And that's sort of what I did with the book. I do indeed have a lot of cases in the book that were brought directly to me. And, you know, those are included in there. And I really delved into the various possibilities to explain what these things are. So, you know, I like to credit the other people who've done the work also. And of course, you know, today I've sort of moved beyond that. As I said earlier, I'm fascinated with all aspects of this stuff. I get these accounts constantly still, but there are a lot of other investigators out there who are collecting them too. And it is a phenomenon that's growing at an incredible rate.
Well, and me and Kyle were blown away by most of, or if not every one of the accounts of the Black Eyed Kids, whether they can be substantiated or not. They're still extremely, extremely creepy stories.
But what we wanted to talk to you mainly about was, now you had a book come out last year called Strange Intruders, and that had in it a lot of the stuff that me and Kyle really enjoy.
That's right. Strange Intruders came out last fall, and it covers a wide range of essentially entity encounters. It ranges from the Djinn to the Grinning Man. I cover the Slender Man, which I know you guys are kind of interested in that whole mythos. It covers Pukwudgies and a wide range of other things. It really is sort of the book I set out to write before I did Black Eyed Children. You know, something that presented this concept to people that, look, all around the world, there are these weird encounters that take place. And you can go back through history. It's not a new phenomenon. You know, you go back to just bizarre things like, the Mad Gassers, you know, the Mad Gasser of Mattoon in Illinois. And there was a Mad Gasser before that in Virginia. You got Spring-Heeled Jack in London. So all through history, we find these really weird humanoid encounters that people are having, and there seems to be a string of these accounts, and then all of a sudden they stop, and a phenomenon like it or something, you know, a slight variation will pop up somewhere else. And it gives you this sense, when you start looking at the overall picture, that there's this other intelligence or this other level of existence that intrudes into our world sometime. And that's sort of where I went with the book. And I made no bones about the fact that it was very inspired by the work of John Keel, one of my big influences as I grew up researching these types of cases. And, you know, I hope that on some level, you know, it sort of has a Keelian flair about it. People have told me that it does, and that was sort of what I set out to do. So if that's the case, then I was indeed successful.
Well, I have read that the book has been compared to John Keel's, The Complete Guide to Mysterious Beings. It's like you've written is an updated version. I'm like, that's a heck of a thing right there. It'd make me feel great.
Well, that's a huge compliment. I hadn't heard that one. I did hear somebody compare it to to John Keel and H.P. Lovecraft combined. I thought, wow, that's a compliment and a little unsettling all at the same time. But if that's the case, you know, that's great. I just want people to, mainly I want people to ask their own questions. And I don't make it my agenda to try to prove or disprove anything. I like to go out and research and investigate this stuff. I'm very hands-on, as you guys know. I like to be out in the field talking to the witnesses and seeing the locations, if at all possible, and looking at the evidence. And then I just like to present it to people as an investigative journalist would do, and let people make up their own minds. You know, I take real issue with, you know, for instance, skeptics that are so adamant of convincing people that, you know, something's not real. But then I don't believe in skeptics. Nobody's proven to me that they exist. So it's all good.
That's right. Well, let's jump off into a few of the things that we talked. The thing, I guess, that always really kind of caught me with some of the older stories of, like, the Black Eyed Children and things that you brought forward, and even, like, especially when I went to reading more about the tulpas and the djinn and all that, is it almost feels like it's all actually the same thing to me. Like, it's all, maybe it's a different version by how they can approach people in other areas, where it's something we can relate to, or it's something like another tribe has named it and things like that, is the way it feels almost. But the whole, I guess the thing that gets me the most is when I really start thinking about the tulpas, the fact that maybe we actually do have the ability to create some of these things. And that's the thing. What have you found? I mean, because it does seem that way. I mean, I've heard some of the things of your other interviews and read some of these things of, like, even I believe it was a Mr. Murphy's experiment, the Pearl experiment. And they actually got together and it's almost irrefutable that something was formed in a group like that.
Right. And you're referring to Bill Murphy. He's a great friend of mine. And, you know, I've participated with him in some of these experiments. And it really is, it's mind-bending when you start looking at some of the things that happen in these cases. We can really go back, prior to that, and look at the Philip experiment.
This happened in the 1970s, and it was a group of Canadian parapsychologists who got together and decided that they would create a ghost so that they could then contact it and see if they could establish any kind of communication with the entity that they created. Now, what they did was this group got together and they created a person named Philip Aylesford, who had never historically existed, but they gave a lot of historical facts to his history. And at the same time, they left a few things that were just not quite historically accurate, as a fail-safe in some fashion. And after they created the background on this spirit, they then attempted to contact him. Now, bear in mind, this was the 1970s. The experiment began, I believe, in 71 or 72. And Toronto, Canada, this group sits down and they begin to try basic spirit communication. Now, this kind of thing was very popular at the time. Ouija boards were in fashion, table tapping, all kinds of psychic phenomena. This group sat down and they started doing circles to communicate with Philip and asking him questions. They started to get answers. Philip started to interact with the group.
Now, did most of this group not even know that it was a joke, that it was just put up, right?
Well, it wasn't a joke.
By other people.
No, they knew what they were doing. The group got together to do this intentionally. And, they gave a full background to his life. They created a tragic death for him and all these various things. And as they started to establish communication, this spirit of Philip would begin to answer questions, not only just simple yes and no questions, but he began to reveal things that were very personal to members of the group that he really couldn't possibly know. They began to have other phenomena. They had the table they were using began to move. They had purported levitation. And, this experiment went on for a period. It was obviously very successful, but for personal reasons, the group decided to end the experiment at some point. Now, this really gets into tulpa territory, which is, what we kind of preface mm-hmm. this with. And the idea of a tulpa, incidentally, is an ancient Tibetan term. It roughly translates in Western language as thought form, but really that doesn't completely encompass what a tulpa is. A tulpa is something that is created initially within your mind. It's pure thought, but as the process unfolds, the thought begins to take form until it becomes completely physical and tangible. Hence, it becomes a living being. Now, the Philip experiment did not go that far. They carried it to the point where this entity was in spirit form and was communicating with them. The experiment, incidentally, has been repeated numerous times in other locations. There was an Australian group that had a great deal of success creating their own entity. And there was another group in England that did something similar. So, this experiment, it can be repeated, and people do get different degrees of results from it. We could sort of go down the rabbit hole when you start looking at this, because it around the fact, okay, is it, that the collective consciousness is creating this being that is then interacting with the group? Or is it, that there was a entity, another spirit there that took this convenient projection and attempt at communication and pretended to be Philip? We get into a lot of different
That's incredible.
Possibilities as to how this is actually happening. But when you start looking at the variations of some of the experiments, it becomes very fascinating. The experiment that Bill Murphy conducted in California, which was called the Pearl Experiment, actually ended up a pretty interesting result, because they essentially created the background for this woman named Pearl, who supposedly had been in the Glen Tavern Inn and had, you know, she had a whole tragic story, but she was described as wearing a green dress and a pearl necklace. And after the experiment was conducted, a gentleman came to the Glen Tavern Inn and was taking photographs. And there is a, there's a reception area in the main part of the Glen Tavern Inn, and to the left there are a pair of doors that open up into a dining area, and there's a big mirror in there. And he was taking pictures in this lobby area, and he caught this strange reflection in the mirror. And this photograph, it's stunning. It's a woman in a green dress. And, you know, it perfectly, I mean, it's a period dress. It perfectly fits in with the description of Pearl. Now, CSIs have gone into this location and attempted to recreate this photograph, and they couldn't do it.
Man.
This is, you know, everyone I know, you know, dozens of investigators that have looked at this, and I've been there myself. I've looked at this thing from every angle, and you know, Bill and I sat in the lobby one day, and we were talking about this and just looking at all the different possibilities, and it just doesn't seem possible to recreate it. It's quite an enigma.
Wow, that's exceptional. I've never even heard of something like that. So when they create these backgrounds, what do they, like, write out a background, pass it out amongst the group, and then they all collectively read it and then meditate on it? Is that how they manifest this thing?
Well, there are variations of it. I mean, there was one group that basically, you know, they sat down and they said, as a group, they said, okay, we're going to create this entity. This was the a small group in England, and you know, they sat down and they said, okay, we want to create this spirit, and we're going to, you know, take suggestions for names. So, you know, they pitch some names around, they decide on a name, then they start just all contributing to the background of this character. And you know, they create a basic background story for the person. Okay, it was, you know, this is what happened, this is what they did, you know, they were poor, they were wealthy, you know, whatever it is, and they just they sort of sketch out the person's life, and they say, this is the background of this person, and you know, this was the tragic death that occurred, and you know, this is why the spirit is stuck here, and now let's try to communicate. And there you go.
It freaks me out a little bit, because it just still feels more like the trickster element that these things kind of get involved in when you start going down these paths. Is it just makes me think that this is something that's just playing with us, is what it's doing.
Now, if you really want to go a little bit further into this and hear something that I think is very eye opening, have you guys ever heard me talk about the Myrtles Plantation?
Ooh, I don't think
so. No, I don't think so.
Is this going to make me lose sleep, David? This is already getting bad.
You guys know about the Myrtles, obviously.
Yes.
Purportedly one of the most haunted locations in the country.
Yes, sir.
And amazing place. It really is a beautiful old plantation home, you know, in the Bayou country. And it is well known for its, you know, wide range of spirits that haunt the place. And anybody who knows anything about the Myrtles, you know, most people, if they know anything about it, when you ask them to name one of the spirits there, more than likely they're going to come up with Chloe. Now, the story of Chloe is the most popular story there by far. It's told, it's repeated numerous times a day on the ghost tours at the Myrtles. You know, people go there to do ghost hunts and stay overnight, and, you know, there are events held there. People have gotten some amazing evidence of Chloe. They've gotten EVPs. There's a photograph that, as far as I know, it's never been debunked. It's an incredible picture. It's in black and white. If you Google it, you're going to be able to find it on the net. It's a depiction of, it's an apparition of a woman in a slave period dress with a turban on her head. and she's standing between the main plantation building and the secondary building that's just behind it. There's a little alleyway, and this photograph that someone caught.
Today's episode is brought to you by Vinted. So recently I did something I've been avoiding for way too long. I looked through my closet. And apparently my closet has been operating under the assumption that every piece of clothing I've ever owned deserves permanent residency. You know those clothes you keep because you're definitely going to wear them again? Yeah, sure you are. I'm not going to lie. I bet 60% of the clothes in my closet, I never wear them anymore. I'm not talking about summer clothes or winter clothes. I mean, there's stuff in there that I haven't worn in years. So I finally started cleaning things out. And instead of letting those clothes continue their very successful careers as closet decorations, I listed some of them on Vinted. Now, if you haven't heard of Vinted, Vinted is a secondhand app that makes it easy for everyday sellers, people just like you and me, to sell pre-loved fashion and make some extra money while doing it. And I was pleasantly surprised by how simple it was to get my stuff listed on Vinted. Listing items is quick and simple. And once the item sells, Vinted creates the prepaid shipping label for you. But here's probably my favorite part. Vinted has no seller fees. So when you sell something, you keep everything you earn from the sale. The Vinted app is also free to download. That definitely makes cleaning out the closet feel a little more worthwhile. Instead of staring at clothes I haven't worn in forever saying, well, maybe someday I'll wear that again, I can put them on Vinted, clear out some space, and give those clothes a second life. So go take a look in your closet. Seriously, go do it. There might be some extra money hiding in between the shirt you forgot you even owned and the pants you swear you're going to wear again. Ready to clean out your closet and make some extra money? Download the Vinted app for free and start listing. That's V-I-N-T-E-D. There's no seller fees. You keep every dollar that you earn. And for a limited time, you'll enjoy free shipping in the U.S. on Vinted. That's Vinted. Give your clothes a second life and start listing on Vinted today.
It's this, you know, ghostly apparition of this woman standing. And it's very clear. It's not, it's not any kind of vague blob or orb or anything like that. You can really distinguish that this does appear to be an African-American woman with a turban and a long dress on. Now, everyone got very excited about that because, you know, this person had caught an apparition of Chloe. And the story of Chloe is that she was the mistress of the plantation owner at the time, and she got caught listening to one of his business conversations, and as a result, she was punished by having one of her ears cut off. Now, that's why she wore the turban after that. But the story goes that Chloe was getting a little bit older, and she started to fall out of favor, and she was getting very worried about being made to work in the fields or something again, and thought that the plantation master was going to replace her with another lover. So she decided that she would get back in good graces with the family. And to do that, she baked a pie and put poison in it to poison the, excuse me, I think it was a cake. Either way, she she poisoned the children and thought that she had used just enough to make them sick and that she would be able to nurse them back to health and hence, you know, sort of be the savior of the family. But she used too much poison and the children died. The slaves had found out what she had done, the other slaves, and they hunted her down and they hung her. Now, as I said, Myrtle's, you know, it's a amazing location. Thousands of people go there every year doing these ghost hunts, hoping to make contact, catch evidence of Chloe. Well, here's the kicker. Chloe never existed.
What? They just made this the Chloe story up when they started doing all this?
There is no historical documentation of a slave named Chloe ever being at that plantation. Further, when you start digging into the history, what you find is a number of things. First of all, the plantation owner was known for being very devoted to his wife and not taking any mistresses during the time period. Beyond that, the children that did die are do show up in the historical record as having died from the yellow fever, something that plagued a lot of the communities during that time period. So there's no evidence that anything about the story is even partially accurate. And what happens is you see it start coming in sometime probably in the 80s. And as the story grows, you know, well into the 90s, it starts getting repeated. It gets published in books. It's been repeated on television. And like I said, it's now this vital part of, you know, the whole Myrtle's mythology and the ghost tours and everything else that are done there on a regular basis. And you go and do one of the ghost tours and they'll show you, you know, this is where Chloe, you know, baked the cake. And this is, you know, this is where this is, this is where the children would eat, you know, the children who died from the poison. And, you know, historically, there's no Chloe. So we then have to ask the question, if that's the case, how and why are so many people catching all this evidence of Chloe?
Yeah, where did she come from?
Yeah.
This is another one of those situations where, you know, we could argue this a number of ways. We could say, okay, well, we know that the Myrtles is sort of almost a vortex for, you know, various spirits. There do indeed appear to be a lot of entities that gravitate towards the place. You know, did one of them decide to start taking the Chloe role and, you know, manifesting, you know, with that vessel somehow? Or is it the collective consciousness of so many people who believe the Chloe story and go there in order to experience Chloe and hopefully, you know, make contact or see her, that they are co-creating a tulpa into existence?
Man, that is freaky. It scares me because I've done tons of research on the Slender Man for our show. And, you know, I often read that thinking about Slender Man actually creates him. So that seems like that's what's going on in all these cases. If you dwell on it, you almost open yourself up to a djinn or the Slender Man. You know, everybody knows that the Slender Man, you know, was created like in 2009 on a website. But since the collective people have been, you know, creating these false stories, that actually the collective consciousness has actually manifested this thing. And that's just...
Yeah, and the Slender Man is a great example. I mean, you know, there's so many weird things about that story. You have to consider, though, you know, was the Slender Man... is that a tulpa that's being created from the collective consciousness? Because there's actually a lot of people now who don't know that the Slender Man was just completely made up.
Right. But has it manifested it now? You know what I mean? That's bizarre.
Right. Right. And there was, you know, there was a quote from, of course, Slender Man, for those who don't know, was indeed created on a forum as part of a contest. And the contest was to create a paranormal themed photoshopped image that could be posted on the internet and made to go viral.
Right.
So, you know, all these, if you go back and it was very tedious, but I actually went back and read through all of that from the beginning. And, you know, you get a lot of silliness at the beginning, people making up, you know, different hybrid cryptids and aliens and all kinds of things. And then, and a lot of them are very outrageous. And all of a sudden, this guy posts this very subtle image and, you know, as he begins to add more postings, it really did something to people's subconsciousness, I think, because, you know, he didn't post some gory picture or some, you know, crazy animal. He posted this very simple thing. And the first few postings about the Slender Man, first of all, they don't call him the Slender Man. He's just this mysterious figure that is in the background, and he's connected to these supposed tragedies that were happening, you know, a fire at a school and things and disappearances. And it really, it's amazing because when you go back and read through all of this, you can see a mythology being created. And, you know, that in itself is quite fascinating. But then you have to look a little bit deeper and say, okay, you know, what exactly is this doing to the collective consciousness of people? You know, one of my favorite quotes is there was a guy who posted on the forum, and he was simply, his username was I, and he posted this one line, and it said, "The Slender Man, he exists because you thought of him. Now try and not think of him.
Yeah, right?
And that's, you know, that's creepy.
It is creepy. I mean, it seems like it might not have started out real, but now, because of everybody thinking about it and writing about it and stuff, it's almost become real. And also, right. like you say in your book, you know, it's what is this throughout history? This isn't a new thing. People have been seeing strange, long-armed entities, boogeyman or whatever they want to call it. There's names in every culture all over the world of this similar type creature. That this is not, I mean, this incarnation might be a new thing, but there's always been something in the collective of people throughout the world and throughout history that, you know, what is this thing? It's always seen. It always revolves around the disappearances of children, or people see entities in their room, shadow people, djinn sometimes. You know, what is this that all throughout history there's always people seeing these entities?
That, exactly. And, you know, that brings up another question in terms of the Slender Man, and that's are we, you know, through this collective experiment, simply tapping into something that was already there, or making contact with something that was perhaps dormant? And, you know, through this focus, all of a sudden we've given it attention. You know, it's like the old psychological thing when you tell people, you know, don't pay any attention to red cars. And, you know, the subconscious doesn't hear that negative. The subconscious, you know, pings red cars. And you're going to be more likely to notice every freaking red car that you see, mm-hmm. you know, for the next several days. You know, the same thing works with children, you know, having nightmares. There's this whole thing where you can, if they're having nightmares, you tell them, okay, well, whatever you do tonight, don't dream about big fluffy bunnies. And, of course, it you know, helps alter that subconsciousness, and it changes the direction of the thoughts. So, you know, in this case, we've got thousands of people focusing on this negative idea of this Slender Man, this, you know, creepy character that's lurking in the shadows. And something is happening as a result. There's no doubt about it.
Man, that is interesting. Now, moving on. The Grinning Man. Now, I know, I think John Keel first referenced that from sighting in New Jersey a long time ago. I think I read somewhere that you had an encounter with a Grinning Man. Is that true?
I did. It's documented in Strange Intruders, as a matter of fact.
Could you tell us about that?
I don't want to hear any more, David. Damn it. I'm visualizing very attractive women.
Yeah, and another question, all the thought you put into writing Strange Intruders, where you spend hours thinking about these things, have you noticed any changes around your house?
Yeah, right? I'm going to visualize something way better than the Grinning Man.
Pamela Anderson.
That's
young.
Right.
Maybe I could create a Pamela Anderson tulpa.
Don't think about the Grinning Man.
Yeah, thanks. That's going to be awesome. Yeah.
No matter what.
No, oh, God, yeah. The cover of your book, that's what we always get into this with a lot of, is the covers of the books is what grabs people. The cover of Strange Intruders is creepy as hell, man. It's like that whole group just shows up to your house like, what's up, buddy? Like,
I think you can order a poster of it, can't you?
I'm getting one.
There are prints available of the cover. That was done by an artist, a friend of mine in the UK. He goes by Mr. Sam. And the guy is amazing. And he's done, you know, album covers for Rob Zombie. He's done just a whole wide range of graphic stuff. And he's incredibly talented. And, you know, I told him, I said, okay, look, here, you know, I want these particular entities on the cover. I gave him a basic idea. And, you know, what he came back with, it just... I was stunned. I can tell you, when I opened it up that day, I thought, oh my gosh, you know, it's just incredible. And, you know, of course he painted the figures, and they're sort of behind a big piece of glass that is starting to shatter, which is exactly what I wanted. You know, this concept that these things are coming through somehow.
That's the rock band of creepiness in that photo is what that is.
Yeah, pretty much is, isn't it?
Man. So you had an encounter with a Grinning Man.
I did. This was back in the 80s. And
here we go.
It was, first of all, do you guys know what the Grinning Man is?
Well, like I said, I think I read about it. I think it was a John Keel story in like some boys in New Jersey first encountered him one time, like at a park or something. I think that was the first thing I read about it.
Yeah, the Jersey Grinning Man, this was in the 1960s. This was 66. It was a wave of UFO sightings in New Jersey. And there was, they were being seen around an explosives factory, around a reservoir. Police officers were spotting, UFOs. And this was a little town called Elizabeth, New Jersey. These two young men were walking home. They were walking along the street, and there was an embankment that sort of went down to the side to where the turnpike was. And it was this high wire fence that served as a barricade between the street and the turnpike itself. And as these two boys are walking along, they see this bizarre figure who's standing against the fence down this embankment. And they described him as being very, very tall. And he was wearing this weird, like a green jumpsuit and that they described as coveralls that sparkled and reflected the streetlights. He had this huge belt on his waist, and they described this face that he was making as being just bizarre. They said he had this massive grin on his face, and it obviously really creeped them out, and they went running away from this character. And as Keel sat down and interviewed them, and he found them very believable, and he started later finding these other strange stories of these grinning men like characters that would show up in random places. Sometimes they would show up in people's homes. Just a really weird phenomena. It seemed to often be tied to UFO reports. And my own account, this was from the 1980s. I was driving with a friend of mine, and he was at the wheel. I was in the passenger seat. We were driving along this whole area in North Carolina, and there is occasionally a farmhouse, but it's pretty much just overgrown woods, and you can't really even pull off on the side of the road because it's just weeds and right into trees. And we're out for this nice drive, and as we approach this one stretch of road, I see on the right-hand side ahead of us, standing just off the side of the road, a figure. And I could tell it was a person, obviously. And as we got closer, I'm thinking, I even said something to my friends. This is really odd. Why would somebody be way out here? There's no vehicles around. When we approached this person, I could see that he was very tall. He was wearing almost a top hat. It wasn't quite as high as a top hat. He was wearing a long coat. He had one of his hands behind his back and the other up sort of under his chin, rubbing his fingers together. But the disturbing thing was the expression on this figure's face was, the thing I thought of in the aftermath was the Joker, the Batman villain. Mm-hmm. Anybody who's seen the artistic depictions of this hideously large grin, impossibly large, and only someone could grin physically that much. So this really hideous smile on this figure's face that was frankly unnerving. And to some people that sounds like, oh, come on, you saw a guy smiling. No. It was not just that. It was this really weird experience. And as we approached this figure, it was one of those moments when time sort of slowed down. It was as if we were going by this thing in slow motion. And I'm looking out the windshield at first and then the passenger window at him. And in the few seconds it took me to turn my head from looking out the passenger window to turn it fully around and look out the back windshield, this figure had moved and was now standing in the middle of the road watching our car.
Looking for a little Hollywood-style fun? Check out Ryan Seacrest's 10K Ways exclusively at Chumba Casino. There's 10,000 ways to play. Get spinning for free at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
And there's Hammer no down. Way there's no way someone could physically move like that. It's just it's impossible. And of course, being the type of person I am, I immediately started saying, you know, stop the car. And you know, I'm telling my friend, his name was Tom, I said, you know, you gotta stop. And he, of course, was refusing. So, you know, we argued for you know, a few seconds. I finally get in, convince him to stop the car and say, look, just turn around. I just want to see if he's still standing there. You know, we had went around a curve and a slight curve. And I finally convince him to turn the car around. He goes back part way. There's nothing. This guy is gone. And of course, at that point, I jumped out of the car and ran up to see if I could find anything, any kind of physical evidence, any sign of you know, a path or something this character could have went down, you know, anything similar. And there was just nothing. There was evidence that something had stood there, you know, in the weeds on the side of the road. But it was just mashed down grass. There really wasn't any kind of distinguishable print. And, you know, the trees were so thick that you couldn't even get through, you know, the woods very easily if you tried, let alone if you were wearing the kind of getup that this guy had on.
And this is just out in the middle of nowhere when you drove up on it.
Yeah, this was just in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah.
And, you know, the evening, it got stranger because that later that
they got it. We'll call you, Dave. If you can hear us, we'll call you back. If they got you, we'll try to find you.
Why does this creepy shit happen whenever we're doing stuff like this?
I don't know.
This shit's creepy.
See what happens when you talk about all this shit?
That's just what we were saying.
That's what you're saying, yeah.
We're like, holy shit, we go, Dave, if they got you, we're going to help find you.
So what was the last thing you heard?
Of how much stranger the night got. And we're like, then it went away. And we're like, Dave, we're like, no shit. You sure that night was strange? Because this shit's getting strange.
Okay, so.
I don't know if I can go have beers with Dave. I'm scared already, man.
You guys are part of the whole thing now.
Yeah, right. You're like, oh, God.
Just don't think about the Slender Man.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, great. I'm over. So, I'm drawing things out on my notepad of these grinning faces and shit. I'm like, oh, this is awesome.
So the, David, start with, so the
evening,
night got crazy.
Yeah, say as the night goes on, it got stranger. Yeah.
Evening after this weird encounter, there was an electrical storm in the area, and the house next door to the friend who was driving, his name is Tom, the house next door to him was struck by lightning that night. And you know, he found it kind of weird. I mean, the fire department came and was able to put out the fire, and it wasn't really much extensive damage done, but it was kind of strange. And he had, you know, he called to tell me that. And right after that, about a half hour or so, another friend rang me and said, David, listen, my mom and my sister just saw a UFO. And of course I thought, okay, here we go.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was in the same area. It was in the same general area. It's about 5 miles from Tom's house. And, you know, it just collectively, when I started looking at all the strange things that had come together during this period, it got more and more curious. Now, I spoke to John Keel about this much later and, you know, told him my Grinning Man encounter and just talked to him about some different things. And he told me, he said, look, you gotta go back and look more extensively for UFO sightings during that time period, because I guarantee you there were some. And I had looked pretty thoroughly in the area, I thought, you know, but what happened was, as a result of talking to him, I said, you know, I think I'm going to readdress this again and see what else I can find. So what I did actually find was, in the next state over, I didn't live very far from the state line. In the next state over, I had a contact who was part of a small UFO organization, and they were independent researchers and had been gathering stuff for years. And when I sat down and talked to them about this, they said, yeah, we've got some reports from around that time period. And they did indeed have some, you know, strange things that they had received. And, you know, it turned out that that there were some various accounts. In fact, there was one woman who had given them a report. And all she said was that she had seen what she described as a figure dressed like a hobo clown running across the road.
Don't think about that.
Anyway,
during that time period. So, yeah, you know, it's one of those things that you look at the collection of weird events and you kind of, it's intriguing and you have to wonder what was going on, but it's all part of this weird puzzle that I think we're all still putting together.
So it seems like you have made there has at least been a correlation between UFOs and the Grinning Man more times than not.
Yeah, there certainly seems to be. There certainly seems to be.
Hmm. Well, recently me and Cam were interviewed on a podcast with our friends Manny and Crystal on All Day Paranormal podcast, and they were asking us about the djinn. And mm-hmm. You know, I was going to ask you about the djinn because you have a vast wealth of knowledge on the djinn. What do you think the djinn are? And are the djinn the same thing as shadow people? Or are they demons? Or do you think the all three are separate?
Wow, this is that's a whole show right there.
Okay. Here we go.
So a synopsis. First of all, I have had, I think, more people write me about the djinn than I have anything else.
Really?
Even the Black Eyed Children. With questions and sometimes reports. It was amazing. You know, after the Black Eyed Children book came out, as expected, I had a lot of people contacting me and passing along their encounters. But it was amazing how many people were asking about the djinn and, you know, asking if there was a connection and just asking various questions about it. I've also had a lot of military people contact me asking about the djinn or reporting things to me. Now, the djinn, you know, these things are ancient. In the Western world, they've been kind of, they've been made comical, really, because you say djinn, and first of all, a lot of people don't know what you're talking about. People are becoming a little bit more aware now, but, you know, typically you have to say, okay, well, it's a genie, which is the Western interpretation. And then, you know, you get one or two things popping in their minds. It's either the big blue guy from Disney, you know, who's running around helping people. Or if you're a little bit older, you get Barbara Eden in the hair
right,
and pants.
Yeah. You know? That's what I'm talking about. That's what I'm talking about right there.
Don't think of Barbara Eden in the hair and pants.
Yeah, too late.
You know, you get one of those two images, but the problem is that both of those are they're jokes. You know, they really are. They're meant to be fun. They're comical, and that sort of gets into dangerous territory because it is, in a way, allowing this these djinn to sort of come into our world in the back door. And, you know, the problem is that what I like to point out to people is we have circumstances now where for 10 years, Western soldiers have been, you know, active in the Middle East, the homeland of the djinn. And they are over there with little understanding of the culture and the history of these things and how it connects to the various regions of the Middle East. And, you know, I get reports all the time of people having an incredible range of problems from poltergeist-like activity to, you know, illness in the family and lots of other things. And a lot of times if it's a service person, you know, it'll come back around to, oh, well, you know, I bought this thing in Iraq and I was told it had a powerful djinn in it. You know, I bought this souvenir or this piece of jewelry or you know, whatever it is. And they're bringing these things really home and around the world. The djinn, you know, you go back and study the whole mythology of the djinn, it's very tied into the belief system itself of Islam. In fact, if you're Islamic and you don't believe in the djinn, then you're not being true to the religion. You know, it's part of the religion that you believe in the djinn. And in that lore, the idea is that Allah created three races. He created humans, he created angels, and he created djinn. When the other two races were ordered to bow down to the superiority of man, the djinn refused, and as a result, they were banished. Now, this gets really fascinating for me because the whole concept of this race of beings being banished is something you find repeated around the world, either that they're banished or that they left of their own accord or they left because of a war. And you find this in various mythologies. And this other race of beings, although they were banished or they left, they didn't really leave because they still exist all around us. Now, that says to me that we're talking about something interdimensional, that they were banished to another level of existence that coexist with ours. And indeed, when you start looking at the concept of the djinn, you'll find that the tales say that they can live anywhere. They can live in the wind. You know, they can live in abandoned buildings. They can be entrapped in different things. And, you know, that's sort of where we get into the whole mythology, the genie in the bottle, you know, or the genie in the lamp. That comes from really the medieval period when a lot of people practicing magic began to get the idea of binding a djinn to an item. Often it was a piece of jewelry that they could carry with them in order to make this djinn do their bidding. But these are very much trickster figures, and they have their own agenda. They're not interested in faithfully serving anyone. They may make it appear that way at first, but really their agenda is much more sinister.
That just the thought of bringing one back as a keepsake or a joke or something is that's what they told me in a little trinket shop, is that this necklace or this little jar had a djinn in it, you know, and I bring it back to my house. The idea of, I guess, of not knowing, it's almost kind of like buying like an exotic pet that you don't know anything about. You just thought it was cool and you get it home, except this one could be 10,000 times worse.
Right,
I mean, this is because when you describe that, the Islamic belief, and of the three races, it feels like it is like a division of a lot of the other religious beliefs. Is that's more the demonic side of life is what that is.
Yeah, very much so. You know, in the Western world, we would interpret that as demons. And in fact, you see a lot of correlations, because if you look at the medieval period in the West, you'll find a lot of people practicing magic and attempting to bind demons, you know, to force demons to do their will because of the level of power they have. So it really, it very much correlates. But the whole thing with the djinn is much more sinister, I think, because they are so widespread. And, you know, I think it's a growing concern, because Islam is the fastest growing religion in the world. And when you start looking at the Islamic faith in different countries, you'll find that they have carried this tradition of the djinn with them, and it is often sort of melded into the culture of the place. So, you know, you can go to places in Southeast Asia and you'll find, for instance, people who practice the martial arts and practice Islam, and they're blending the djinn in with what they're doing as a combat method. So, you know, they're doing all these strange things like, you know, enchanting rings and pendants with djinn and trying to use them against their enemies and so forth. And it really is tinkering with something that few people have much of an understanding of.
Yeah, that sounds like playing with fire whenever you got on like gasoline pants. Like, that's not really the best
thing. Yeah, because how do you turn it off?
Yeah, and you really can't. You know, there are going to be consequences one way or the other.
Yeah, you always hear the stories of, and at least in the children's tales and things, is as you grow up, is the genie will grant you three wishes, but it's never the three wishes, you know, that you want to have. It's, you know, you want certain things, but it's always like they take something away as a joke. It's part of the things that you think you're going to help your family, you know, but it really doesn't. It kind of backfires on you every time.
Yeah, and what I'm seeing happen a lot, quite honestly, is, you know, the scope of powers that are attributed to the jinn is pretty large, and they are supposedly able to shapeshift, to appear in a wide variety of forms of anything from an animal shape to, you know, people, even deceased people. They are able to speak with the voice of anyone they choose to. They have a wide range of psychic powers. And what I see happening a lot of times is a typical scenario is a guy comes back from the service and, you know, he starts hearing voices, and it'll be the voice of what he thinks is, you know, his deceased mother or, you know, another relative or loved one. And this spirit, in quotes, will begin to give him information, you know, psychic information, and say, well, you know, listen, go to this place on Tuesday and you'll get this job. And, you know, what often happens is that it does initially seem beneficial. You know, the person will have a string of good fortune that will happen from the result of listening to this guidance. And it's all a trap. You know, it's sort of like the spider luring the fly in, and once it's in, you know, it can't get out. And these people come back and they get very dependent on this psychic information, or the information starts, you know, directing them towards very negative things, and starts to cause a wide range of misfortunes to the person and their family. And as I said, some of the things we see very typically are poltergeist-like activity, you know, very serious illnesses with family members, and you know, problems with relationships, loss of finances. There's a whole wide range of things. And it's interesting, too, because a lot of these guys that I speak to, it sometimes will take quite a while before they will realize that they've brought something back. And, you know, it makes me start to wonder, there's been enough of these cases that I have to speculate, you know, is there something that these entities are doing to suppress that memory? Because these guys, you know, you can ask them a dozen times, okay, you were in the service, you know, what did you bring back? You know, what souvenirs, what, you know, I need a list of every single thing you brought back with you. And, you know, time and time again, they'll be consistent with the list. No, this is all there was. This is it. And then, you know, 4 months later, oh my gosh, you know what? There was this necklace that I bought, you know, this guy said it had a powerful gin in it. I've had it here the whole time. I forgot it was here. And, you know, often the case is that there's something there. There's something that they brought back that this entity is attached to somehow.
David, does it seem like these gin, are they feeding on our misery or our sadness? Is that kind of what keeps them going?
You know, I think that they're satisfied by it. If you start to read the whole mythology of the jinn, what you find is that because they were banished, they are very hateful towards humans, you know, and there's a level of arrogance there because they don't believe they should ever had to have bowed down to humanity. And, you know, there's a motivation to get revenge because they feel like they were wronged. So it really does get into sort of a combination of the trickster archetype and also, you know, these entities that you get the sense that they're just very bitter and angry and out for revenge to some degree.
Man, it does. It just feels so dirty evil like that. It just, like, I don't know, man, I hate it. And I know, just like we were laughing about, but it's like you talk about them, it's almost like ringing a bell. Like, I don't want to even bring them up anymore. I'm done.
Well, and you mentioning the soldiers bringing stuff back, that reminds me of the movie, the original Exorcist movie. At the very beginning, they find this artifact, and that's brought back, and that's what kind of brings that possession on.
Right.
Yeah, I do not like that at all. Another thing that you cover is something that I am personally fascinated with, and I love the stories of the little people. I'm a big fan of the Fae and of, like, the Wendy and the Puckwudgie and all of these creatures, they kind of seem to walk in both worlds, but they're very small creatures, little leprechauns and things like that. Why don't you lay on us some Puck Wudgie talk?
Yeah, you know, it's fascinating because you say little people, and of course, everyone's mind immediately goes to, you know, the legends of Ireland. And I think, oh, okay, you know, Ireland, the Emerald Isle, and, you know, the leprechauns and all the little people. What a lot of people don't realize is that, once again, these are legends that we find all over the world. And North America itself has a very rich history of these little people. You know, they show up in different forms. A lot of Native American tribes have a wide range of legends surrounding these little beings. And, you know, we're talking about humanoid figures that are anywhere from a foot to, you know, a couple of feet tall or so. And if you look at certain areas in the country, the Cherokee, they have a whole range of tales about the little people, the Ute Indians in the Southwest. And, you know, they'll have areas that are designated as being taboo because, oh, that's little people's domain. There are modern sightings. A lot of people don't realize this, but, you know, in the U.S., there are still modern sightings of these things. I've talked to people who have told me incredible stories, and they say, you know what, I would never let this story be written or talked about because I can't believe I actually saw this, but I know I saw it. The Pukwudgies are pretty unique in that there's a whole rich history that we're very aware of with the Pukwudgies. Now, they are exclusive to, for the most part, to the area of Massachusetts. They're very much tied into the Wampanoag Indians, and the history of these little people are that they were a race who lived here along with the natives. At the same time, they were very separate. They kept to themselves. For a period, they actually assisted the Native Americans. You know, they would sometimes leave them food or you know, help them, you know, just with small things. But for some reason, there was some animosity that grew between the two groups. And the Pukwudgies became very not just trickster-like, but they started getting very ugly and were, you know, stealing things and causing deaths in the village and so forth. Now, the natives called out to their cultural heroes. His name was Mashop. And Mashop was this giant that came along and essentially said, okay, I'll take care of the Pukwudgie problem. He picked them up and he flung them to the far corners. So there's a period during which they are supposedly gone. They just aren't there anymore. And
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Game night's fun until someone spends 5 minutes lining up one shot. Chalk, breathe, re-chalk. Still aiming. While they figure it out, I fire up Chumba Casino. I can spin anywhere, anytime, and there's always a new social casino game every week. Spins happen way faster than that shot. Play now at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba. Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Then all of a sudden they return. And when they return, they're really nasty. And you know, the story is, of course, they're so angered by the encounter with Mashop that they're now back with a vengeance. The natives call out for their hero again. But the difference in this particular tale, and this is unusual when you look at mythologies from around the world, the cultural hero loses. And there are some variations to the story. You know, some versions say that the Pukwudgies killed him. You know, they shot him with poison and he sank into the water. Some say that they just defeated him and drove him away. But either way, this is sort of the end of the hero. And the Pukwudgies have stayed there ever since. Now, they are described as being a couple of feet tall. They live in the forest. They wear clothing that is made of natural material. So, you know, things like bark and leaves and so forth. They're mostly humanoid in appearance, and some people will describe them as looking like, you know, miniature Native Americans with the ruddy skin. But what's weird is that there are still a lot of sightings and encounters with these things. And, you know, people describe them as being very trickster-like. Some people will say that they have a very sinister air about them. Through the years, different things have been attributed to them. For instance, there's an area, and this is in the Bridgewater Triangle. I'm sure that you guys are familiar with that term. There are a lot of Pukwudgie encounters reported in that region, and the Pukwudgies purportedly run all around the woods in the Bridgewater Triangle. They are blamed on a number of deaths that have occurred in the region. There are stories that they will lead people astray. They will lead people to a ledge and either push them off or trick them into, you know, getting too close to the edge and losing their balance. And, you know, we find all these different accounts that come up, as I said, even as recently as this year. You know, I've heard accounts of people seeing these little beings in the forest in that region.
Really? That's incredible.
I'm curious about what's going on up there now. I'm ready to go. I'll go deal with them. I'm not messing with the others, but I'll go deal with the Pukwudgies.
Now, David,
just remember, if you're going to the Bridgewater Triangle, you're not getting just the Pukwudgies. You're getting a whole lot of other things, too.
Now, have you been there to that?
Oh, yeah.
Anything crazy happened to you there?
You know, we saw some ghost lights, is what a lot of people call them, moving through the forest. Now, that sometimes is tied to the Pukwudgie stories because there are accounts that people will see a dancing ball of light that will sort of lead them off the path, and it will stay just far enough ahead that you can't quite be close enough to it, and it seems to have consciousness of its own and will sort of lead the person off. And at some point in some of these encounters, people say that the light will vanish and a little creature will show up, one of these Pukwudgies. Now, you know, when we saw them, we just saw these the forest and tried to get closer, but they ended up vanishing, and they showed up again later on, and this happened a couple of times. But the Bridgewater Triangle itself, you know, it's a hot spot. There are so many different stories out of that region. This is one of those areas that I find these really fascinating. This is one of my favorite things to pursue, are these window areas, you know, these portal areas. Keel called them windows. I like the term portal area because I think these hot spots are areas where the veil is just a lot thinner, and they're probably access points for these other dimensions of existence. But there are areas like the Bridgewater Triangle where we see a high concentration and a wide range of activity, you know, UFO sightings, cryptid encounters, hauntings, even things, you know, even things on the physical, like weird, you know, ritual crime, you know, bizarre things like that. I mean, the Bridgewater Triangle has a whole history of, you know, supposedly being an area for the mob dumping some of its victims, for satanic ritual being carried out, and all kinds of other strange things. And when you go into these areas, you know, there's a different quality about them. It's just not like small town America. When you know, if you really pay attention and you know, listen to all your senses, you'll know that something else is going on at a deeper level in these areas.
It's one of those places that the minute you get there, there's just an uneasiness about it.
Yeah, there is. And, you know, there's a lot of these areas around the country. There's a Bennington Triangle in Vermont. I was there last year. There, of course, is the Superstition Mountains, one of my favorite areas in Arizona. There's the Uinta Basin in Utah. You know, in the middle of all that is the Skinwalker Ranch.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you find these places really all over the world. And as I said, I consider them portal areas. And I think it's really important to look at these places and look at the wide range of phenomena and begin to, you know, hopefully get some sense of what we're dealing with here.
Now, David, you've covered a wide variety of beings tonight. Is there anything else in your new book strange intruders that we haven't touched upon that you think our audience needs to know about?
You know, it has a wide range of things. We hit some of the high points, and you know, if I pique your interest, pick the book up and learn more. There's a section on the oily man in India. There's a section on shadow people, which is something that a lot of people are interested in right now. You know, these shadow beings that are showing up again around the world. There's a few cases of reptilian-like beings that have shown up, and it kind of runs the gamut.
Right on. Well, tell people where they can get your book, that one and the Black Eyed Kids.
Absolutely. The books are available at leprechaunpress.com, and you'll find Strange Intruders, Black Eyed Children. There's a DVD on tulpas on there and a couple of other things. And you can follow more of my work at my blog, which is twocrowsparanormal.blogspot.com. That is TWOCROWS paranormal.blogspot.com. And there's a badge on there for my Facebook. People are welcome to friend me on Facebook and keep up with the various events and other projects that I have going on.
Awesome. We're going to put links to all that on the show notes. Do you have any presentations or speeches that you're going to be doing?
I've got a few things. I've got, I'll be at Paranoia Con in August. That's in San Diego. I'll be speaking at the Paradigm Symposium again this year in Minneapolis, and that is an amazing event. I will be speaking in England for a couple events this year. I'll be at the Paracon UK in November. I'll be at a special Halloween event that more details will be coming up for, and a wide range of things. I have quite a few things lined up in the fall, so the best thing to do is check my blog and watch the updates there.
That'll be awesome. Yeah, I'm sitting across from Receding Hairline Man right now in this room, so that's one of the creepy guys I have to deal with.
Well, thank you so much, David. I know you've been very busy, and thank you for catching up with us. And thanks for coming on and telling everybody about your stuff.
Yeah, thank you so
much.
Hey,
it's been a pleasure, guys.
Back with Expanded Perspectives from the Archives. I hope you enjoyed that interview. David's a really cool guy. The last time I saw him in person was about 2 years ago. We were at a cryptid roundtable gathering in White Settlement, Texas, and he was there, and we had a chance to catch up. He's a really cool guy. Like I said, man, go check him out on Amazon. He's got all kinds of great books on everything, and you'll really enjoy it. But that's all the time we have for this episode. Till next time, I'm Kyle. Peace.
Looking for a little Hollywood-style fun? Check out Ryan Seacrest's 10K Ways exclusively at Chumba Casino. There's 10,000 ways to play. Get spinning for free at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21+. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.